Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for a Monday, April 5th, 2021. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen calling for a global minimum corporate tax rate to stop what she said has been the nations of the world 30-year race to the bottom, countries trying to outdo each other by lowering tax rates to attract business, and in the process reducing the revenue available to governments to provide public services. This all comes as the Biden administration wants to increase corporate taxes to pay for the more than $2 trillion infrastructure plan put forth by the president. The CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, pointing to a case study of a bar opening in rural Illinois, leading to more than 40 COVID-19 cases as a warning against failing to take precautionary measures to stop the spread, even as millions of people in the U.S. are getting vaccinated every day. Minneapolis Police Chief Madaria Arredondo testifying in the trial of Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd, saying that Chauvin absolutely violated department policies when he knelt on George Floyd's neck for 9.5 minutes. Those policies include de-escalation, use of force, and duty to render aid to people who need it. And President Joe Biden wishing everyone a happy Easter alongside the Easter Bunny and First Lady Jill Biden on the White House balcony. The White House annual Easter egg roll was canceled for the second straight year due to the pandemic. But the president said he's looking forward to celebrating with everyone in person, quote, next year, God willing. Associated Press writes that U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on Monday urged the adoption of a minimum global corporate income tax, an effort to offset any disadvantages that might arise from the Biden administration's proposed increase in the U.S. corporate tax rate. Citing a 30-year race to the bottom in which countries have slashed corporate tax rates in an effort to attract multinational businesses, Yellen said the Biden administration would work with other advanced economies in a group of 20 to set a minimum. Yellen spoke to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
Another consequence of an interconnected world has been a 30-year race to the bottom on corporate tax rates. Competitiveness is about more than how U.S. headquartered companies fare against other companies in global merger and acquisition bids. It's about making sure that governments have stable tax systems that raise sufficient revenue to invest in essential public goods and respond to crises, and that all citizens fairly share the burden of financing government. President Biden's proposals announced last week call for bold domestic action, including to raise the U.S. minimum tax rate and renewed international engagement, recognizing that it's important to work with other countries to end the pressures of tax competition and corporate tax base erosion. We're working with G20 nations to agree to a global minimum corporate tax rate that can stop the race to the bottom. Together, we can use a global minimum tax to make sure the global economy thrives based on a more level playing field in the taxation of multinational corporations and spurs innovation, growth, and prosperity.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. The U.S. has also been in talks with about 140 countries to reach a global agreement on a minimum corporate tax level. That's being led by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD. President Joe Biden has called for raising the U.S. corporate income tax rate from 21 to 28% and also increasing the tax that companies pay on offshore earnings from 13% to 21%. That's all to pay for his infrastructure proposal that's now before Congress. The president defended the tax increase and the spending plan against Republican criticism that much of it is not truly for infrastructure. The president speaking to reporters outside the White House.
You talk about a lot about infrastructure today. And it's kind of interesting that when the Republicans put forward an infrastructure plan, they thought everything from broadband to dealing with other things was trains or infrastructure. Now they're saying that there's only a small portion of what I'm talking about is infrastructure. The fact of the matter is that when you're in a situation where you can't turn out a water fountain in school and worry you're going to drink polluted water and take your health, replacing all those pipes with infrastructure. I'm talking about making sure that you take asbestos out of school. That's infrastructure. I'm talking about building high-speed rail. That's infrastructure. I'm talking about making sure you're in a situation where you can redo some of the federal buildings that are just absolutely leaking energy every single day. That's infrastructure. In addition to roads and bridges and highways and broadband. So it's interesting how their definition of infrastructure has changed. But they know it. They know we need it.
Are you afraid that a higher tax will drive corporations out of the country?
Not at all. Not at all. Look, the tax, because there's no evidence of that. The tax was 36%. It's now down to 21%. And the idea that's bizarre. We were talking about a 28% tax that everybody thought was just fair enough for everybody. The idea is you have 51 or 52 corporations of the Fortune 500 haven't paid a single penny in tax for 3 years. Come on, man.
Mr. President, other than how to pay for the plan, where is the room for negotiation with Republicans? What parts of your plan are you willing to do away with, given the definition of infrastructure here is so different?
Well, I'm not going to negotiate with you on that.
Well, no, but what would you...
No, but I mean, why would I say
what
that?
What would you tell the American people about where you're willing to compromise?
People, I'm going to push as hard as I can to change the circumstance so we can compete with the rest of the world. Compete with the rest of the world. Everybody around the world was investing billions and billions of dollars in infrastructure. And we're going to do it here. Thank you.
And Mr. President, are you concerned about a fourth wave of coronavirus?
President Joe Biden on the White House lawn Monday morning, returning from a weekend at Camp David in Maryland. You heard the helicopter in the background. The House and Senate not in session again this week. They're continuing their holiday recess. They are back, however, next week. On corporate taxes, Associated Press economic reporter Chris Rugeber tweeting today, mixed messages. Biden calls the idea that his proposed higher corporate tax will cause some companies to relocate overseas bizarre. At the same time, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urging G20 to negotiate a global minimum corporate tax precisely to prevent businesses from seeking lower tax rates overseas. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, a key senator on the Democratic side in a 50-50 Democrat-Republican split Senate, today came out against the 28% corporate tax rate. He says he's not the only Democrat who feels that way.
I think I heard you say that you would support raising the corporate net income tax. This bill calls for it to be raised from 21 up to 28%. When it was cut, all right, hang on a second. When it was cut under Trump, you did not support the cut. You did not support the cut in the 2017 tax bill. So what do you support in terms of increasing corporate taxes?
There were so many cuts in the 2017. And I can assure you, if you go and talk to the average person, the working person, middle class, or the working poor, they will not tell you they remember any of the benefits they received from that bill. Most of that went to the higher income brackets. And we also incurred another $1.9 trillion of debt. And that's when people are raising Cain about the one we're doing now with the new COVID package. I guarantee you the $1.9 trillion is going to be invested and help a lot more people. But with that being said, we can close the loopholes. Hoppy, do you know there's an average of $400 to $500 billion a year that we don't collect from the upper echelon because they report their tax and their earnings much differently than the average person? And we're missing a tremendous, tremendous amount of money that should be collected. So let's collect what we should. I think corporate should have been at 25%. But other than that, basically, all the loopholes need to be uncollected.
But right now the proposal is 28.
No.
This bill proceeds as it exists now and raises the corporate from 21 to 28. You would not support that bill?
Well, the bill basically is not going to end up that way.
Well, that's where it is now. They could do it by reconciliation, Joe.
They can't, not unless we vote to get on it. And if I don't vote to get on it, it's not going anywhere. So we're going to have some leverage here, and it's more than just me, Hoppy. There's six or seven other Democrats that feel very strongly about this. We have to be competitive, and we're not going to throw caution to the wind.
At Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, today on the Hoppy Kirchhoff program on West Virginia Metro News' Talk Line show. At the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki asked to respond.
And then on Manchin, is the White House open to reducing the corporate tax rate?
Well, first, the president felt it was responsible to propose a way to pay for his proposal. That's exactly what he did. He knows some members think it's too big, some think it's too small. Frankly, there have been folks who have come out on both sides. which we fully expected. He knows that some will come forward with different ways to pay for this package, and some may have views that it shouldn't be paid for at all. So we fully expect that from Senator Manchin and other members, and we expect the question of how to pay for the package, if we should pay for the package, to be part of the discussion moving forward.
The White House is open to that conversation.
We're open to hearing ideas and proposals from members, and we encourage them to put them forward.
Press Secretary of the White House, Jen Psaki, and the modifications, the proposed modifications to the president's plan may be beginning. Politico reporting, a trio of Senate Democrats unveiling a proposal Monday to raise taxes on multinational corporations. The framework released by Finance Committee Chair Ron Wyden and fellow tax writers Sherrod Brown and Mark Warner generally agree with what the administration proposed last week when it called for a host of tax hikes on corporations, but it differs on several points and includes additional details. One of the president's Republican critics on a proposed tax increase is Senator Roger Wicker, and he was on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday.
What the president proposed this week is not an infrastructure bill. It's a huge tax increase, for one thing, and it's a tax increase on small businesses, on job creators in the United States of America. And Chuck, you made a statement that I just have to wonder about. You said it seems the administration is more eager to have bipartisanship than members of Congress are. How could the president expect to have bipartisanship when his proposal is a repeal of one of our signature issues in 2017, where we cut the tax rate and made the United States finally more competitive when it comes to the way we treat job creators? He reverses all that, and I'll tell you what, he says no one will pay extra taxes if they make less than $400,000 a year. That may be true. We'll have to see the details there. Okay. But under this tax increase bill,
yeah,
there are a lot of people making $100,000 and $50,000 that are going to lose their jobs because of the extra burden this plan would put on job creators.
Senator Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi, on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. You heard earlier President Biden, without being prompted by a question, talking about the Republican criticism of his $2 trillion infrastructure spending proposal, that it funds things other than infrastructure. That point was made by Republican Senator Roy Blunt on Fox News Sunday.
I think there's an easy win here for the White House if they would take that win, which is make this an infrastructure package, which is about 30%. Even if you stretch the definition of infrastructure some, it's about 30% of the $2.25 trillion they're talking about spending. My advice to the White House has been take that bipartisan win, do this in a more traditional infrastructure way, and then if you want to force the rest of the package on Republicans in the Congress and the country, you could certainly do that. You'd still have all the tools available for what is clearly going to turn out to be another purely partisan exercise. I think it's a big mistake for the administration. They know I think it's a mistake, and I also think it would be an easy victory if we go back and look at roads and bridges and ports and airports and maybe even underground water systems and broadband. You'd still be talking about less than 30% of this entire package, and it's an easily doable 30%, I think, Chris.
Senator Roy Blunt, Missouri Republican, on Fox News Sunday. By the way, one of the five Sunday TV talk shows replayed each Sunday on C-SPAN Radio starting at noon Eastern. As mentioned, the Senate and the House not in session this week. They're back next week. Follow the process on consideration of this more than $2 trillion infrastructure spending bill and how to pay for it on the C-SPAN networks. The House is always live, gavel to gavel on C-SPAN TV, the Senate live on C-SPAN 2, and you can listen to both on the free C-SPAN radio app. On Wall Street today, the Dow was up 373, NASDAQ up 225, S&P up 58. Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 both hitting new record highs. White House COVID-19 advisor Andy Slavitt saying the U.S. is vaccinating against the coronavirus, an average of 3.1 million people per day. More than 40% of adults in the U.S. have had at least one shot, nearly one in four adults now fully vaccinated. But at the same time, new infections and hospitalizations are increasing, blamed in part on new virus variants circulating, and outbreaks in some states like Michigan leading to concerns about another potential surge. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky telling of a case study showing the continued importance of preventive measures, especially masks and social distancing.
I want to briefly describe now a report in today's MMWR that describes what can happen when we do not follow proper mitigation strategies, when everyone is not fully vaccinated. The Illinois Department of Public Health and staff from a local public health department evaluated a COVID-19 outbreak associated with a bar in a rural area of Illinois. The bar accommodates about 100 people and held an opening event indoors in February. While table spacing and signs encouraged physical distancing and masking, people who attended the event reported that mask use was inconsistent and that 6 feet of distance was not maintained. The evaluation found 46 COVID-19 cases linked to this event. Of those, 26 were patrons, 3 were bar staff. 17 secondary cases occurred among contacts of people who attended the opening and got COVID-19. 12 were household contacts, 3 were long-term care facility contacts, and 2 were school-related contacts. Transmission associated with this opening event also resulted in 8 households with infections, a school closure affecting 650 children, and the hospitalization of a long-term care facility resident. As we work to get more people vaccinated and as community businesses begin to reopen, these findings underscore the vast impact of a single event affecting communities, schools, families, and fragile elderly. And it emphasizes the impressive transmissibility of this virus and the continued need for layered prevention strategies, including reducing the number of people indoors, improving building ventilation, and utilizing outdoor spaces as the weather allows.
Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, during today's virtual White House COVID-19 response team briefing. CDC also updating guidance for cleaning and disinfecting facilities and homes to prevent the spread, saying the science shows people can get infected via contaminated surfaces, but the risk is low. Regular cleaning of these surfaces with soap or detergent works best. No need to disinfect unless there was a confirmed case of COVID-19 in the area in the past 24 hours. Over the weekend, Health and Human Services Department putting Johnson & Johnson in charge of the Emergent BioSolutions facility in Baltimore that contaminated 15 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine and stopped drug maker AstraZeneca from using the facility. Some follow-up questions today for Andy Slavitt, the senior advisor to the COVID-19 response team at the White House, and also a key member, Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Last question will go to Meg Tyrell at CNBC.
Well, thanks. I wanted to follow up on the situation at the Emergent plant and the AstraZeneca vaccine being moved elsewhere. And Dr. Fauci, I saw in a Reuters interview last week, you noted the timing may just work out so that the U.S. doesn't actually need the AstraZeneca vaccine. And I wondered if you guys could just touch on, you know, is there any additional capacity for the AstraZeneca manufacturing to move to here in the U.S. and what you kind of expect for that vaccine, for the Emergent plant, and any effect on Johnson & Johnson's ability to meet its April goal of 24 million doses, considering that it needs FDA authorization at that plant to meet that.
Thanks, Megan. Why don't I start this, and if there's anything you'd like to add, Dr. Fauci, feel free to add. I mean, first of all, it's important to mention anytime discussing the issue at this plant that all of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that's available in the U.S. has been authorized by the FDA. None of it came out of this plant in question. And I think it's very important that we begin by making sure that Americans are assured of that fact, that we have safe and effective vaccine, and no vaccine will leave any factory unless authorized by the FDA. The second is that, as has been reported over the weekend for those who didn't follow, with assistance from the Health and Human Services Department, Johnson & Johnson has taken complete control of the plant in question. As Meg's question just indicated, they did made a couple of important decisions. One is they're bringing in a senior level of expertise and management from Johnson & Johnson. And second, that they are going to make the Johnson & Johnson vaccine the only vaccine made in this plant to eliminate the potential for any cross-contamination. The HHS applauds both of those moves, and so it's important for the public to know that those steps have been taken. I'd also want to just point out that this was a decision that HHS made with Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca in complete collaboration. And so AstraZeneca also agreed that this was the right course. As for what this says about the AstraZeneca vaccine in the U.S., and I will go to Dr. Fauci in a second, it says absolutely nothing about our belief one way or the other. We are still, this was not a decision that had any way, anything to do with any concerns about the AstraZeneca vaccine. It is still scheduled to go through the FDA's authorization process as soon as an application is submitted, and they are working on where they would continue to move their production, but don't believe that there is any impact on their production schedule based upon what's happened. So, Dr. Fauci, what would you want to add or reinforce to that?
Well, you know, Andy, a lot of things get conflated in the questions that were asked, but I think you pointed out the important things. A, that we still are going to rely on the FDA for the evaluation of the AstraZeneca. That's something that we do all the time, and that's really very important. B, the J&J doses that have gone out had nothing at all to do with the situation in the plant. We want people to really appreciate that those who have received the J&J doses, that had really completely dissociated from the issue that we were talking about in the plant. And third, J&J has assured us that they will actually have the 100 million doses by the end of May, as they promised. So we want to make sure those things don't get lost in the discussion about the issue at the emergent plant.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, also Andy Slavitt, White House COVID-19 Response Team Senior Advisor, during today's White House virtual briefing. New York Times writing, an ardent advocate of protecting some of the world's poorest countries from COVID-19, has been selected to lead the Biden administration's vaccine diplomacy in an effort to corral wealthier nations into distributing the vaccine more evenly around the globe. Gail Smith, former U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator and chief executive of the One Campaign to Eradicate Preventable Diseases, will step into the role, a new post at the State Department. Ms. Smith was introduced by Secretary of State Antony Blinken and then made some remarks.
I fought some viruses in the past, and I've learned two lessons. The first is that if the virus is moving faster than we are, it's winning. The second is that with unity of purpose, science, vigilance, and leadership, we can outpace any virus. America's done it before. 18 years ago, a Republican president launched a bold initiative to take on the HIV/AIDS epidemic. A Democratic president went on to expand that mission and scope. In 2014, the Obama-Biden administration, with the strong and generous support of Congress, defeated the world's first Ebola epidemic. Our challenges now are two. First, to shorten the lifespan of a borderless pandemic that is destroying lives and livelihoods all over the world. And the second is to ensure that we can prevent, detect, and respond to those future global health threats we know are coming. American leadership is desperately needed, and I'm extremely confident we can rise to the occasion. I'm honored to be here, and thank you very, very much.
Gail Smith is the new COVID Global Response Coordinator for the Biden administration today at the State Department alongside the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. The U.S. has contributed or pledged $4 billion so far to COVAX, the World Health Organization's vaccine distribution initiative, which is now servicing about 80 countries, set to go over 100 countries in the next few weeks, as long as vaccine doses are available. Today, the COVAX Managing Director, Aurelia Wen, gave an update in an event hosted by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund.
So I understand that COVAX intends to distribute about 2 billion doses by the end of this year. How is it going? What are your plans to scale up distribution, and what do you see as the main challenges?
Yes, so we have secured agreements for more than 2 billion doses for 2021, and at least 1.3 billion of those doses are ring-fenced for the 92 lower-income economies, and they will be paid by donor funding through the Gavi COVAX Advanced Market Commitment, or AMC. But securing doses is only one aspect of it, and this is going to be the largest and the most rapid global deployment of vaccines ever. And we're very much at the beginning of this. So what we need is funding. And we've had very, very strong global community support to be able to raised $6 billion so far. And in the next 2 weeks, actually, we will be launching an investment opportunity hosted by Secretary Blinken to raise the remaining of our funding needs. We're also going to need to think about the work that's going to take place for delivery. And overall, I think very much sort of keeping a focus on the fact that COVAX is an investment that we are making for all of us. Vaccines are going to be a key part of getting the world back on track and making sure that we have health and an economic recovery. And then looking forward, also thinking in 2022 and beyond, making sure that we stay ahead of the changing epidemiology, making sure that we keep having the right vaccines to prevent transmissions, addressing new variants, and following the science.
COVAX Managing Director Aurelio Wen with IMF Deputy Secretary Sabina Bada. While vaccine distribution is happening in much of the world, the World Health Organization also says that more than 30 countries have not yet even started or barely started giving out doses, and it includes many countries in Africa. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. The Supreme Court ruling on the side of Google in a long-running multi-billion-dollar copyright dispute with Oracle. Oracle accusing Google of using some of its Java platform computer code to create the Android operating system, which is used on most smartphones today. Supreme Court voting 6-2 in Google's favor. Supreme Court also dismissing a lawsuit by seven people who had responded critically to former President Donald Trump's tweets and then claimed he retaliated by blocking them, violating their First Amendment rights. Supreme Court said that now that Donald Trump is out of office, the issue is moot. And a new poll finds about half of Republicans believe the attack on the U.S. Capitol January 6th was mostly a nonviolent protest. And 60% believe the election was stolen from Donald Trump, the poll coming from Reuters and Ipsos. The trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin and the death of George Floyd in May 2020, now entering week two. Today, one of the witnesses was the city's police chief, Madaria Arredondo. He testified that Derek Chauvin's putting his knee on George Floyd's neck for 9.5 minutes was not an appropriate use of force.
Is what you see in Exhibit 17, in your opinion, within Minneapolis Police Departmental Policy 5-300 authorizing the use of reasonable force?
It is not.
And why not?
That is, it has to be objectively reasonable. We have to take into account circumstances, information, the threat to the officer, the threat to others, and the severity of that. So that is not part of our policy. That is not what we teach, and that should be condoned.
When do you believe, or do you have a belief as to when this restraint, the restraint on the ground that you viewed, should have stopped?
Once Mr. Floyd, and this is based on my viewing of the videos, once Mr. Floyd had stopped resisting, and certainly once he was in distress and trying to verbalize that, that should have stopped. there's an initial reasonableness in trying to just get him under control over in the first few seconds, but once there was no longer any resistance, and clearly when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
Minneapolis Police Chief Madaria Arredondo, questioned by Minnesota Special Assistant Attorney General Steve Schlechter. During cross-examination by the defense attorney, Eric Nelson, he did focus on whether these rules under the police guidebook are hard and fast, or they deal with the circumstances and what the police officer might be going through. There was also this, as the police chief was shown two videos and asked to comment.
You would agree, Chief, that from the perspective of Miss Frazier's camera, it appears that Officer Chauvin's knee is on the neck of Mr. Floyd.
Yes.
Would you agree that from the perspective of Officer King's body camera, it appears that Officer Chauvin's knee was more on Mr. Floyd's shoulder blade?
Yes.
Minneapolis Police Chief Madaria Arredondo was allowed to testify today about police training and tactics, was not allowed to discuss his firing of Derek Chauvin. C-SPAN has been covering this trial on C-SPAN 2 television. You can listen on the free C-SPAN radio app. If you miss any of it, we re-air it the same day, 8 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN 2. A former aide to Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz says he believes allegations against the congressman as part of a federal sex trafficking investigation are baseless and fabricated. Nathan Nelson held a news conference in front of his home in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida, part of Gaetz's congressional district in the northwest part of the state.
My name is Nathan Nelson. I was the former director of military affairs for Congressman Matt Gaetz. Last Wednesday afternoon, two members of the FBI came to my house unannounced to question me about allegations surrounding Congressman Gaetz. They told me that members of the media reached out to them asserting that I had previous knowledge of Congressman Gaetz's involvement in illegal activities. They asserted that because of that knowledge, I resigned my position as the Director of Military Affairs. I'm here this morning to state that nothing could be further from the truth. Neither I nor any other member of Congressman Gaetz's staff had any knowledge of illegal activities. I've known the congressman for over 6 years when he was a state rep in the Florida House. I worked with him for 4 years as his Director of Military Affairs. Everybody here in Northwest Florida and the defense community knows that I had a planned departure. I left to continue supporting the military mission in a private capacity, helping to align the Department of Defense, defense industry, and academia for workforce development here in the Panhandle. This baseless claim against me leaves me further convinced that the allegations against Congressman Gaetz are likewise fabricated and merely an attempt to discredit a very vocal conservative.
Nathan Nelson, former staff member to Congressman Gaetz and a U.S. Air Force veteran at his home in Florida. Gaetz is accused, among other things, of having a past sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl and paying for her to travel, potential violation of federal sex trafficking laws. Congressman Gaetz, writing an op-ed in the Washington Examiner, denying that he slept with an underage girl, suggesting the accusations against him by political foes stem from anger that he loathes the swamp, and also said, no, I am absolutely not resigning. His first public comments, written comments now, in this investigation. This from the Moscow Times. Western countries growing increasingly nervous in recent days over signs of a Russian military buildup close to the conflict in eastern Ukraine and on the annexed Crimean Peninsula. The conflict in eastern Ukraine, which broke out in 2014 following Ukraine's pro-Europe Maidan revolution and Russia's annexation of Crimea, has seen repeated flare-ups since a ceasefire was brokered in 2015. But the warnings and statements coming from Moscow, Kyiv, and Washington are the most serious and strongly worded in months. That was from Moscow Times. A question about it at the U.S. State Department briefing and spokesman Ned Price.
I just want to ask very clearly, what is the U.S. assessment on Russian troop movements near the eastern Donbas region in Ukraine? Do you believe Russia is getting ready for a fresh offensive? And what is the United States prepared to stop that? President Biden said, offered his unwavering support. In what form will that be?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not my job to speak to what might be motivating the Russians. It is my job to speak to what the United States government is doing about it. And let me say very clearly, as I did last week, that we are concerned by recent escalating Russian aggressions in eastern Ukraine, including the credible reports that have been emanating about Russian troop movements on Ukraine's borders and occupied Crimea. The movements were, of course, preceded by violations of the mid-2020, the July 2020 ceasefire that led to the deaths of four Ukrainian soldiers last month on March 26th, I believe it was, and the wounding of two other Ukrainian personnel. Russia's destabilizing actions undermine the de-escalation intentions achieved through the OSCE brokered agreement of July of last year. And in addition to our reassurances to Ukrainian officials, we're discussing our concerns about this increase in tensions in ceasefire violations and regional tensions with NATO allies, of course, and the other week in Brussels. This was a broad topic of discussions. We've asked Russia for an explanation of these provocations. But most importantly, what we have signaled directly with our Ukrainian partners is a message of reassurance. You saw that in the readout that President Biden had of his call with President Zelensky of Ukraine. Of course, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan spoke with the head of the presidential office, Andrei Yermak, last week as well. Secretary Blinken in this building spoke with Ukrainian Foreign Minister Kuleba. And Secretary Austin spoke with Defense Minister Andrei Teran, and I believe the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff also spoke with his counterpart. So at the highest levels of government, literally, across multiple institutions, we have sent that message very clearly to our Ukrainian counterparts and implicitly to the Russians as well, that we stand by Kyiv. We stand by our partner, Ukraine, in the face of this intimidation and aggression.
State Department spokesman Ned Price at today's briefing. Also today, the Russian President Vladimir Putin signing a law allowing him to potentially stay in office until 2036. The law formalizes a constitutional change passed in a popular vote, a referendum, last year. Back in Washington, the annual White House Easter egg roll with roots to President Rutherford B. Hayes' administration in 1878. Well, today, in normal times, it would bring about 30,000 eager children and parents to the White House grounds. But the coronavirus pandemic forced the cancellation again this year for the second year in a row. President Joe Biden wanted to carry on the tradition as best he could. He spoke from the White House Blue Room balcony today, joined by the First Lady Jill Biden and the Easter Bunny, who is wearing a large mask.
Jill and I are, thank you for joining us today. And we have a special guest, as you can see to my left here. And I'm thankful to our friends of the White House Historical Association and the National Park Service for helping us deliver thousands of commemorative eggs to vaccination sites and communities and healthcare centers all across America. Easter's a day of joy when we celebrate resurrection and renewal. But this year, we know many are still going without the familiar comforts of the season. The virus is not gone, and the second year in a row, most will be apart from their families, their friends, and the full congregation that fill us with so much joy. But the scripture tells us, joy cometh in the morning. As we celebrate the renewal of this season, we know that long for dawn is almost here. We will rebuild our nation. We will re-engage and reimagine what we can be. We'll remember that with faith, hope, and love, anything is possible. And we look forward to next year when the White House will ring with joy of the season once again, and there'll be an Easter egg roll, God willing. May God bless you all. May God protect our troops and take care of the Easter Bunny. Thank you all very, very much.
President Joe Biden, First Lady Jill Biden, and the Easter Bunny, played in a costume by the president's military aide, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Brandon Wessling. The bunny later showed up at the White House briefing with Press Secretary Jen Psaki, the reporters, to hand out Easter eggs, and reporters asked whether the bunny would stick around and take some questions. The answer was no, not this time. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Download the free C-SPAN Radio app and get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Hope you have a good evening.